From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Summer is less than a week away, and you're probably well into your vacation planning. Well, here are some things you might want to add to your packing list. Books. Alan Chews has his annual recommendations for summer reading. Get out your pen and paper, and if you miss something, don't worry. We'll repeat the list at the end of the segment.
Wallace Stevens has a lovely poem about summer reading. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The reader became the book, and summer night was like the conscious being of the book. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The words were spoken as if there was no book, except that the reader leaned above the page. Taking my cue from this poem, I'd like to suggest some pages to lean above, some sorrowful and deep, some sprightly and mocking. First, there's a dark novel about losses and gains, public and private. It's Nothing Lost by John Gregory Dunn, who, alas, died this winter. Dunn tells the story of a horrendous murder in our country's heartland and the ensuing tribulations and trials. Here's Joan Didion, Dunn's wife of many years, reading from a secret journal composed by one of the novel's main characters, a brilliant but troubled defense attorney named Teresa Kane.
My father was a gangster. He was, in fact, a murderer. I don't know how many people he actually killed, but there were two cut-and-paste biographies about him and about his role in the opening up of Las Vegas. And he is listed in the Encyclopedia of American Crime as a top hitman, the murderer of 20 or so people, perhaps more. He did not, of course, advertise the number and names of his alleged victims or the means by which he allegedly dispatched them. But then neither did he deny the claims, his silence only further gilding the myth he seemed, according to the tattered clippings about his life, to so enjoy.
Joan Didion, reading from her late husband's last novel, Nothing Lost. A novel came out last winter that I rather savored and saved to recommend to you for this summer. One Last Look by Susanna Moore, the story of two English sisters who accompany their brother on a sojourn to India in the early part of the 19th century. It's a splendid enterprise based on Moore's extensive research into the lives of two English women of the period and a large dollop of her imagination. Here she is reading from this luxurious novel.
There was a bend in the stream, and all at once I could see the masts of ships, hundreds of them, and Fort William in the distance. Henry promises that the whole of the European community can fit inside Fort William for months at a time should it be necessary to seek refuge, although I believe its builders overlooked the necessity of a source of fresh water. I was so overcome at the sight of the ships that I could not speak. Naked men leaned on long poles before a row of white palaces, and men squatted in the shallows, pouring river water over their heads. Bullocks with gilt horns stood chest-deep in the water, and women washed their hair, their breasts bare. "No Englishwoman has hair like that," Harriet said. "Her lisp makes her speech sound old-fashioned. No Englishwoman hath hair like that. Of course she hathn't."
Another powerful book that bears on the lives of women is The Mother Knot, nonfiction by novelist Catherine Harrison, author of The Seal Wife, among other novels, and the controversial memoir The Kiss. This one's a tautly composed memoir about mothering and depression. Harrison makes quite clear the way the past constantly imposes itself on our present lives.
Nearly 18 years before, as she lay dying in a hospital, her tongue loosened by morphine, my mother had called me to her side. "After I'm dead," she whispered, "you're going to be very angry with me." I held her hand and squeezed her slack fingers, but I didn't say anything. I recognized her words as a gift, but I couldn't perceive its magnitude, not at 23, still so many years away from being able to own my desire for vengeance.
Still looking back, this time some 25 years, it was in the late 1970s that one of our country's most interesting science fiction writers, Octavia Butler, published her novel Kindred, about a woman who travels back and forth in time from modern Los Angeles to a slave plantation in antebellum Maryland.
The room seemed to darken around me. I stayed on my feet for a moment, holding on to a bookcase and wondering what was wrong. Then finally I collapsed to my knees. The house, the books, everything vanished. Suddenly I was outdoors, kneeling on the ground, beneath trees. I was in a green place. I was at the edge of a woods. Before me was a wide, tranquil river, and near the middle of that river was a child, splashing, screaming, drowning.
Octavia Butler, her novel Kindred, has just been republished in a 25th anniversary edition, a one-of-a-kind mix of science fiction and social conscience. Also in the mode of intelligent entertainment, I want to recommend a couple of books to throw into your beach bag. A quirky, poish first novel called The Rope Eater by Ben Jones, about a weird 19th century expedition to the North Pole. Jones worked at the National Geographic and did a lot of research into 19th century exploration and puts it to great use in this book. And then there's Shooting the Sun by Max Bird, about an 1840 expedition from Washington, D.C. to Santa Fe to photograph a solar eclipse. This is a book steeped in research about the making of the American frontier and the frontiers of modern science. And Bird beautifully integrates all of this into the story and always keeps you turning the page. Both of these books will make for terrific summer reading for teenagers and adults alike. Back to our own time, and two engrossing new spy novels. Reading these is like eating a meal of desserts. One of them comes from a writer fairly new to the genre. That's John Weissman, whose new thriller Jack in the Box is lavishly sprinkled with scenes and details of state-of-the-art tradecraft. And the other is the latest from Charles McCarry, recognized as one of the American masters of the genre. It's called Old Boys, and it's got everything in it you'll ever need in a story about espionage.
In movies, master spies meet by dark of night in spooky abandoned factories or under elevated highways in a dangerous part of town. In real life, they are far more likely to hold clandestine meetings in crowded restaurants. This is true not only of decadent Americans, but also of everybody else, including the Russians and the Chinese, and even terrorists, though the latter usually choose places run by their cousins, who are also terrorists.
That's Charles McCarry. With his new book, mystery writer Robert B. Parker has brought out not just good summer reading, but a perfect Father's Day book for a sports-minded dad. Double Play, a hybrid novel about baseball, crime, and nostalgia for the 1940s, really takes us back to the ballgame, one of whose main characters is a tough guy who becomes Jackie Robinson's bodyguard during the early days of Robinson's major league career. The story took Parker back to the ballgame.
It was late afternoon before a night game with the Braves. The people were on the street selling programs and peanuts and hot dogs. I stood at the intersection of McKeever Place and Sullivan Place in front of the field. I could see the light towers above the stadium, the name Ebbets Field in white lettering built into the front of the top. The arches, the Palladian windows, the brick facade, the awning-striped canopy over the entrance. I went into the rotunda and bought my ticket and walked up the stairs and out into the interior. Grass, red clay infield, blue sky above, some white clouds, the players in their uniforms. The Dodgers in home white, blue lettering, blue hats. The Braves in road gray, red lettering. Navy hats with red bills, and on their chests a tomahawk.
Again, in nonfiction, some diverse and powerful narratives. Luis Alberto Urrea's The Devil's Highway dramatizes the circumstances surrounding a fatal border crossing from Mexico into the Arizona desert by a group of desperate illegal immigrants. Listen to Urrea vividly recreate one of their last mornings alive.
Dawn offered an astonishment of birds. In the scrub and mesquite hollows there were more songbirds than could be heard in the Rocky Mountains. Crows, sparrows, mockingbirds. The cactus wren would have been making his small noises as he went about his business. A scintillation of singing and squabbling cut into the silence. Feral parrots might have fluttered greenly across the sky, arguing their way toward Tucson. A hawk riding a thermal sounding his scree. The almost cool air hugging the hard pan, not yet ignited by the white flames of the sun, felt blue. It moved slowly with the last stalling breezes of night, where the predators had made their kills white down and scattered gray pin feathers waved like seaweed in a tide. Crickets, wasps, bees, a rusty understory of insectile melody. Before the heat dropped on their heads, the lost men were drowned in music.
In a cooler mode, Rachel Cohen's A Chance Meeting, about the intersecting lives of numerous American writers and artists, photographers and dancers. Here's Cohen reading from her half-factual, half-imagined portrait of Gertrude Stein taking William James's psychology class at Harvard.
After a certain number of dissatisfying fits and starts, Stein might not have been entirely surprised, and would perhaps even have been slightly relieved, had the door to the laboratory opened and Professor William James entered the room. When he came in, if he came in, the experiment went on fruitlessly for a moment, the additional observer making all naturalness impossible. Eventually Gertrude Stein stopped and stood. She was half a foot shorter than James, and they moved toward the periphery of the room. James was very interested in mediums of all kinds. He wanted to know whether the young woman was reporting experiences from some other level of consciousness, which made Stein smile. Professor James's affection for the occult was a subject of fond amusement among his students. He took her emphatic denial with good humor.
And there are many other wonderful vignettes in Chance Meeting about, among other folks, Willa Cather walking in New York City on her way to get her portrait taken by photographer Edward Steichen, and the painful friendship of Hart Crane and Catherine Ann Porter. And as summer closes in, with a little luck, you'll have time not just for reading, but for rereading. I've just reread John Fowles's novel The Magus, published 40 years ago and revised by Fowles in the late 1970s, a novel in which summer seems eternal and the mystery of personality takes its rightful place in life, and the prose makes the landscape of the Greek islands glow in your mind. Below, for 100 miles in each direction, there were mountains, valleys, plains, islands, seas, Attica, Boeotia, Argolis, Archaea, Locris, Aetolia, all the old heart of Greece. The setting sun richened, softened, refined all the colors. There were deep blue eastern shadows and lilac western slopes, pale copper-green valleys, tanagra-colored earth, the distant sea dreaming, smoky, milky, calm as old blue glass. With a splendid classical simplicity someone had formed in small stones just beyond a cairn, the letters Phi, Omega, Sigma, Phos, light. May you all see by such light and lean, as the Wallace Stevens poem would have it, late into the summer nights.
Once again, here are Alan's recommendations. John Gregory Dunn's Nothing Lost, One Last Look by Susanna Moore, Catherine Harrison's The Mother Knot, Octavia Butler's novel Kindred, The Rope Eater by Ben Jones, Shooting the Sun by Max Bird, two spy novels, John Wiseman's Jack in the Box and Charles McCary's Old Boys, Double Play by Robert Parker, The Devil's Highway by Luis Alberto Urrea, Rachel Cohen's A Chance Meeting, and finally, John Fowles' novel, The Magus. You can also find this complete list at our website, npr.org.